Later this month, the United States Supreme Court will devote an unprecedented 3 days to oral argument to determine the constitutionality of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, commonly known as Obamacare. The court's decision will have widespread ramifications on how health care is provided in this country in the future. My guest this morning is Portsmouth physician Dr. Tom Claremont, who has been an outspoken advocate for an alternative to Obamacare, known as the single-payer system. Dr. Claremont, welcome.
Charlie, thanks for having me.
Now, before we get into the particulars of Obamacare and the single-payer system, will you explain to begin with what's so wrong with our current health care system that has prompted all this hue and cry for reform?
Well, there's two major problems. One is cost. Costs are rising at a rate well beyond inflation every year. Most premiums are going up, you talk to employers locally, 10, 15, 20% on average. The city of Portsmouth, indeed, over the past 10 years has had premium increases of 10.45% every year since 2000. The inflation rate during this period was about 1 to 2%, so that we are raising health care costs 5 times the rate of inflation. Fortunately, that rate is rather low at the present time, but what if that ever went up? Can you imagine where we would be? Secondly, the other major problem is access. We currently have over 50 million people uninsured in this country. We have 135,000 uninsured people in the state of New Hampshire, and we feel that these patients should be given access to comprehensive health care. The Obama plan does not do that. At the end of the day, he leaves 23 million people uninsured with full implementation of his plan.
So what then is the single payer system?
So the single payer system is a system which probably would expand on the current Medicare system or some derivative thereof, and would eliminate, for the most part, private health insurance companies in the United States. The government would collect the taxes, and they would pay the physicians, the hospitals, and the other providers of care for their services. They also would pay for the prescription drugs and other amenities that patients need for their health.
So how does this single-payer system differ from socialized medicine?
Well, socialized medicine, of course, is a buzzword that's been used a lot to discourage debate. And unfortunately, it's been very successful in that mission. Socialized medicine is a system like in England where the government owns the hospitals and salaries the physicians as employees. Our own VA system is a perfect example of this. They have, throughout the United States, a number of VA hospitals. We have one in Manchester where the physicians are employees of the government providing services. That's basically the differences.
Now, how is the single-payer system that you advocate distinguished from socialized medicine?
What we would do, basically, is to expand on the current Medicare system. No one calls Medicare socialized medicine. As a matter of fact, it's publicly financed, but privately delivered. We want to continue that method of practice. The physicians would remain in their own practices. The hospitals would remain independent from the government. And the only role for the government in a single-payer system primarily is to handle the finances of that system.
Now, who would be covered under a single-payer system?
So we envision every citizen of the United States would be covered from cradle to grave. No one would be excluded. Our motto really is everybody in, nobody out. And so we feel like every citizen should have full access to the healthcare system of the United States.
And what would be covered under the single-payer system?
The coverage would be comprehensive. It would be, you'd have your own personal physician, as many people do now. You would have your annual exams or acute care visits. You would have specialty coverage. The hospital would be covered. We would cover mental health, dental health, which is very important and lacking severely in this state, and also a vision. We would cover prescription drugs. And I think under some of the plans that have been outlined, we might even expand to cover long-term care. And certainly we would want to expand home care for the numbers of seniors who are going to be increasing dramatically over the next 20 years. That's going to be a very important area for coverage.
Is there anything then that wouldn't be covered under the single-payer system?
Well, I think plastic surgery is the typical one that most people talk about, which is probably not going to be covered. basically, we would cover medically necessary services. That's the term that is used to describe what would be covered.
And who makes the determination as to what is medically necessary?
Well, I think that's an interesting question, and that is an area which is going to be somewhat contentious. You can see that right now on birth control pills in Washington, who should get those and whatnot. Basically, our feeling is that there should be a board of people. In England, for example, they have NICE, N-I-C-E, the National Institute of Clinical Excellence, which looks over the evidence for various procedures, various medications, various tests and whatnot, and makes the decision about whether they're going to cover those entities. We'd also want some input from the public. I think this would be a very important thing. So we would envision boards probably in every state where there would be a lot of local input, a lot of transparency and accountability, so the public would understand what was being covered and what was not.
Isn't this just creating another bureaucracy of which most people just have a severe dread and suspicion?
Well, we need somebody in charge. You know, oftentimes things change, and somebody needs to make some decision. Somebody has to be in charge. One of the problems we have right now in the healthcare system, Charlie, is there's no one in charge. If I have an issue or a problem, there really isn't anyone out there to call. But let me give you a good example. I mean, for years, people were doing hernia surgery. If you had a hernia, the doctor would say, you have a hernia, let's get that fixed. And thinking that it would be something that might give you a problem down the road. Well, then this was finally studied a couple of years ago, and it was found that really you don't need to do that. If the hernia is not bothering the patient, it's not bothering us anymore, and we'll just observe and not proceed to surgery. Well, those guidelines need to come out. We need evidence-based medicine, and somebody has to be in charge to be able to deliver that information to the providers.
Now, how would the single-payer system be paid for?
The single-payer system would be paid for with tax. Although I like to call it a PSA, sort of a play on words, I call it a premium substitute assessment, because for the tax that you would pay, you would get the full coverage I already described. There would be no further out-of-pocket expenses. Our vision is that there would be no copays, no deductibles, and certainly there never would be any pre-existing conditions. Every citizen would be welcome. The current funding for Medicare, the Medicare payroll tax, if you will, would stay in place. The Medicaid funding that is currently available to the states would stay in place. We would expect all businesses to make a tax contribution based on payroll, probably of about 10% of payroll to cover every one of their employees. And the employee themselves would probably pay around 2 or 3% of their income for this additional coverage.
Okay, so I'm a businessman. I'm already having to pay workers' comp, unemployment comp, FICA, Social Security, Medicare, and you're telling me now I'm going to have the privilege of paying yet another tax for this type of coverage. Why would I want to buy into that as a businessman?
Well, first of all, over 60% of businesses are already providing insurance to their employees. So you are, by not providing coverage for your employees, you're actually sort of cheating on the system. You're making more money than your competitor, and we don't think that's right. We think everybody should be participating in the system. Secondly, you're going to have healthier employees because all of your people now will be covered. And so when somebody has a problem, they're not going to be putting it off before they get covered or get checked. They are going to go to their doctor and get that problem taken care of. So you'll have a healthier workforce.
Supposing an individual is not employed, how do they get coverage under a single-payer system?
Well, everybody has some sort of income, some source of income. And so basically, we're looking for a percentage of that income. So there probably would be some exclusions at the lower end. Certainly, if somebody was below poverty, they wouldn't be paying for health insurance. They don't pay for that now. But if somebody had an income, say, of $25,000 or $30,000, we would expect a 4 or 5% contribution for their health care.
So is this, in effect, almost simply another form of government-mandated health care?
It's not going to be mandated. We just want you to pay into the system. Whether you want to participate in our healthcare system that we devise is will be up to you. But we think everyone has to participate, otherwise the system can't possibly work. I mean, you can't buy fire insurance when your house is burning. You shouldn't be able to buy health insurance when you're right in the middle of having a appendicitis. You can't call your agent to get coverage at that time. It's too late. You should have full coverage all the time.
But to use your analogy about fire insurance, I suppose if I want to take my chances and not have fire insurance on my house, I can do that. But I would not have the option not to participate in this single-payer system if I met the income guidelines?
No, you would, but you'd have to pay the tax. You wouldn't have to necessarily participate in the system. This was the whole argument in Virginia. The guy said if it was a tax, they wouldn't even be talking about the individual mandate that the president put out. Because they put a penalty on it, which was not a tax. And that's where they got themselves into trouble with this. And that's why they're going to the court, as you've previously described.
And how would hospitals get paid under such a system?
Yeah, hospitals, we think, should be paid under a global budget. I mean, every business knows what their basic expenses are for the year. I ran my business for years. You have yours. You know what you're paying your secretary, your staff, what you're paying for lights, et cetera. And so we would provide that hospital with a global budget. It would be a negotiated budget, of course. There would be some flux. I mean, obviously, it depends. If you were in downtown, poorer section of Boston, which has a lot of crime and a lot of, gunshot wounds and things, you probably would get a little bit more money for the trauma that they're providing. But in general, the whole system would be geared to paying for the actual cost for the running of the hospital.
So would that include both operating expenses and funds for capital improvements and
new
equipment?
No. We want capital expenses put aside. We think there should be better planning or in a community-wide basis so that unnecessary services or necessary services aren't duplicated. I mean, for example, here in town, for years, Dover ran an excellent radiation therapy program for cancer patients. And in the past couple of years, Exeter Hospital decided they have their own program. Well, I'm not so sure we need two, programs in the Seacoast that do radiation therapy. This may be a duplicate of expense. Another bureaucracy in each hospital has to be paid for, and it runs up cost. Besides, somebody should make a judgment about whether that is beneficial for the entire community.
So where do hospitals get funds for capital improvements, purchasing new equipment and the like, if this program were to become a reality?
There'd be money set aside for that purpose. There would be a budget for capital. Obviously, we recognize that people would need capital improvements. You have to replace an old CAT scanner or whatnot. But I think there'd be more emphasis on a certificate of need and also on community needs. And I'm just talking about Portsmouth per se. We're talking about the wider area so that, for example, we do have bypass surgery capability here in Portsmouth. It would be absurd for Exeter or another hospital to bring that service on. That is well established here. They're doing a very good job at it. Nobody else should be doing radiation therapy, for example, I think. That's another service that Dover has provided excellently for years.
But supposing I need open-heart surgery, and you're saying that Portsmouth Hospital is the only one that provides it, and my physician doesn't have staff privileges at Portsmouth Hospital, or my cardiologist doesn't have those privileges, does that mean that I'm going to have that surgery performed by a cardiologist with whom I haven't built up any previous relationship, but who has staff privileges at Portsmouth Hospital?
Well, you obviously, on the community-wide thing, you would definitely have to go to a certain specialist, provide any service that you needed on whatever specialty level you're talking about. If you needed cardiac surgery, you would obviously want to pick one of their local surgeons. Obviously, if you wanted to go to Boston, that would be an option. We don't think that's a necessary option anymore. We think our local hospital, and all the local hospitals really, have upgraded their quality of care. It's quite outstanding now. So I don't think the necessity to leave town is there. But you're right. If you were living in York and your doctor was at York, certainly he could refer you down here for surgery at Portsmouth. That wouldn't be a problem. You have full choice of doctor and hospital in a single-payer system. Not something you're going to have as we get into these networks and whatnot, where you're going to have restrictive, and you'll see that happening in Boston right now, where for a lesser fee, you restrict your activity. If you needed to go to the Dana-Farber, and you may not be able to go there because they're not participating in that network. That wouldn't be a problem in a single-payer system.
How do doctors get paid under this system?
Well, it's interesting you ask that question because historically, you know, we have a fee-for-service system, which many feel is what is the main driver or one of the drivers for increasing healthcare cost. A whole literature has emerged thinking that perhaps physicians should be paid salary on a yearly basis, you know, whatever they think is appropriate salary for each physician or each group of physicians, certain specialties or whatnot, so that there would be disincentive to do more or to do less. You'd be paid for the services that you provide, but there would be no risk of gaming the system, say, by doing additional surgery. So, for example, in the Wall Street Journal a couple of weeks ago, there was an article about spinal surgery. Now, here, our doctors are very conservative in terms of doing disc surgery. But there's a doctor in California who was during surgery on practically everybody who walked into his office implanting a device which he developed. So he was getting paid for doing the surgery, for selling the device, sort of a commercial arrangement as well. The whole thing was unethical and inappropriate, and they called him out on it.
So are physicians under this system free to charge the market price, or is there basically a schedule set that says, all right, if you're doing this particular procedure, this is the maximum amount that you can be paid for doing it?
Yes, there's going to be a fee schedule, which we developed between probably the board on the state-by-state basis, I guess, and the physicians. But again, if we went to a salaried position, which a lot of people are advocating for now, then of course that would all be moot because it wouldn't make any difference. You would just do your service and you're going to be paid on a biweekly basis. You get a check and that would be it.
But the salary system is not part of the proposal under the single payer system?
There's no salary proposals laid out at the present time. The research says that countries like Canada, for example, doctors are making pretty much equivalent amounts of money as they do in the United States.
Let's talk about the prescription drug coverage that you alluded to a little earlier. How would the single-payer program impact the cost of prescription drugs?
Well, we think that bulk purchasing is the way to go. For example, the VA system we already mentioned before, their prices for drugs are at 40%. They're only paying 60% of the cost of the average hospital, for example, for various medications because they go out and they buy in bulk for their entire hospital system. That is one way to help control cost. The other is we need some more formulary. What happens today is we've got an inordinate amount of medications, which are what I call Me Too medications. We've got six different ARB medications for hypertension. They're all pretty much the same. If we had only one, it really wouldn't be a problem. We have statins, the medications that people are using for cholesterol. I think there's five or six of those now. We would have those out to bid, I think, and then people would have to bid, the drug companies would have to bid, and we would decide to make purchases based on pricing, not an open-ended system as it is now.
Now, would patients be able to keep their same doctor under a single-payer system?
Yeah, this is the major thing that we think is paramount. Freedom of choice to your doctor and to your hospital, for that matter. We don't want anyone being shut out or forced to see somebody that they don't want to see. It doesn't make sense. There's plenty of physicians available for that, at least locally here. And I think freedom of choice is very important to us.
What would happen to preventive care under such a program?
Preventive care would be encouraged. You know, in most countries, there's a lot more primary care physicians than there are specialists. It's like 2-to-1. In the United States, it's one primary for two specialists. The whole system really has been distorted. So the emphasis now, even under the Obama plan, is, for example, there's no copays or deductibles under the Obama plan for preventative care services. We would incur, and there's this new concept of a medical home where everybody is assigned to a medical home. You pick the home you want to be in, the doctor you want to be with, but then you get most of your care coordination, your prescriptions, practically all of your care through that one entity. And we think that would work out much better. And there'd be much more emphasis on that. Again, with 50 million people uninsured, they aren't exempt from medical illnesses. They have a lot of medical problems and they need care. But the problem is they're getting care. So people say, well, they can go to the emergency room. Well, that's fine. But I always say, well, supposing, Charlie, you have a laceration requiring suturing, and you go to the emergency room and says, my goodness, your blood pressure is 250 over 110. What do you do then? They're not going to provide that ongoing service to you. You've accomplished your goal. You got a tetanus shot and you got your wound stitched up. You need a primary care home where you can get the care, all your care, delivered. So it would be better under a single payer system.
What about portability?
Well, portability is a no-brainer because you have a card which is going to be recognized anywhere in the United States or its territories. Your name will be on it. You are a United States citizen, and you get full coverage in the United States.
Now, obviously, you're advocating a single-payer option, but like everything else that's run by human beings, et cetera, what are the potential disadvantages or downsides of such a program?
Well, I don't really see a whole lot of disadvantages. First of all, everyone gets comprehensive coverage. Everyone gets a primary care physician. Everyone pays a percentage which they can afford. It really, if you're a new business guy and you want to open an office downtown here and you think you want to hire a couple people and the premium is $20,000 per person for health care insurance, that's going to dissuade you from hiring anybody. It's going to dissuade you from even leaving a job which you're on right now. With our system, you would have coverage. It's fully portable. No matter what job you had, or if you weren't even working, you'd still have full coverage. And you could hire someone because you're only going to pay, as in a businessman, 10% of their salary. So if somebody makes $10,000, say, you're only going to pay $1,000 approximately for their health care insurance, not $20,000, which you couldn't possibly afford.
Well, let me suggest to you some possible disadvantages to this type of program and respond to them. Obviously, the government is going to be in charge of collecting the money, but supposing you have an administration that isn't so keen about having a public system, would that not be a potential downside to this type of a program?
Well, of course, one of the best things the government does, people always say the government can't do anything right, but they certainly collect taxes pretty well, I think. I think the voters, this is going to be a transparent system. Again, right now, there's nobody in charge. There's not much out there. You know, there's no place to go. But the voters would speak out. And by the way, we're voting every 2 years, pretty on the House side anyway. And so that I think it would be very difficult to restrict health care. You remember the 1990s when they had HMOs and they began to be some restrictions on care. Denzel Washington had that famous movie, John Q, where he was looking through his policy. His son needed to have a transplant, a cardiac transplant, and the fine print said that wasn't covered. Well, everybody should watch that movie, by the way, to see what he did in that circumstance. But so I don't think that politically that would be something that would be tenable.
Okay. But we've got to have another governmental administrative agency involved here, and it seems you can't pick up the newspaper or listen to a news story without one of the major points being how government seems to mismanage everything it touches. Is there a concern that that would happen here as well?
No, because all we want them to do is to do the financing part. We want local control, really. We have local school boards. You've been on a school board. We don't want the government dictating from Washington about the health care in New Hampshire per se. We would like a New Hampshire board of physicians and public discussing these issues so that we would be transparent and accountable and people would understand what's going on. Now, a lot of this stuff is undercover and below the radar screen. We don't actually see what's going on. That wouldn't happen in a single-payer system.
And finally, as we're experiencing now, in down economic times, tax revenues go down as well. And if you have a program that is relying on its source of revenue on payment of taxes, does that program suffer during a recession when there are less people able to pay into the program, so to speak?
Well, of course, they don't have any problem borrowing money right now. We're at $16 trillion and rising rapidly. I think under those circumstances, obviously, healthcare is the preeminent thing. If you don't have your health, you've got nothing. And so that is where the emphasis should be. So all other programs should be secondary to healthcare programs. And I think that's the way it would be.
Is there any concern that, let's say, an over-aggressive emphasis on controlling costs, so to come in within these budgets, could result in a decrease in the quality of health care?
I don't think so. I think actually it would be better because, again, you'd have a board. Secondly, we are going to more evidence-based medicine now. Let me give you another example. A couple of years ago, there was an article in the New England Journal of Medicine. They said that if you had stable angina, in other words, if you walked two blocks and you begin to have some chest pain, you did just as well with medical management as opposed to a cardiologist doing an angioplasty and putting a stent into your heart. Well, who's enforcing that? Who's looking at what people are doing? There is no mechanism. So under the current system, it's open-ended. A cardiologist could put as many stents in as he wanted, and nobody would say a thing. Under our system that we envision, there would be some accountability. People would be following or tracking, because we'd also go to a record system which would be amenable to review, and we would be following these procedures and see what people were doing and whether they were following the evidence, doing a higher quality, because that would be the standard we'd be looking for.
All right. One of the things you mentioned at the outset was under this program, as I understood it, private insurance companies would no longer exist. So what happens to all the people who used to work for these insurance companies and now find themselves out of work?
Well, for example, I called a doctor yesterday. I had a patient who needed a MRI of their neck. And rather than just me as a physician recognizing the patient needed this procedure to be done, I had to call a doctor, lay out my case, so to speak, and get permission to have this test done. Well, that doctor doesn't need to be there. I knew this patient needed that test. They could be well off back in practice where they should have been in the first place. We have way, way too many administrative personnel, medical personnel in administrative positions. It's ridiculous. And one of the reasons we have a shortage of doctors is I think a lot of these guys are doing this type of work, working for insurance companies, trying to figure out how to let people get the care that they really need. Secondly, how many CEOs do we really need who are making $100 million a year on health care? I haven't the foggiest notion what these guys do, and they get handsomely paid for the work that really the doctors are providing. So I think we would need people, because we'd like to buff up on quality reporting and on evidence-based medicine. So you need a lot of people to do that. But we would pay people off over a couple of years. I think you'd have, you know, retraining if you wanted to do that. These people would be taken care of. Our group estimates it would cost $20 billion to do that. But in a system which is currently costing $4 trillion a year right now, it kind of pales in comparison. So we're not too concerned about the downside of that.
Okay, let's wave the magic wand, and let's assume that the president wakes up tomorrow morning and he says, you know, this is the way to go. This is the direction we're going to go in. How long would it take to get a single-payer system up and running in this country?
Well, first of all, it's interesting you say that, because the president, President Obama, in 2003, in a speech in Chicago, said exactly that. He said, if I had the House, the Senate, and the White House, a single payer would be the way to go, would be able to implement that very quickly. So that's one thing. Secondly, in 1965, when Medicare came on board, it took them 9 months to get that program up and running. This is before computers, mind you. So this was all little file cards people were doing, but they're still able to do that quite well. Having said that, the current bill, H.R. 676, which people might want to review, it's only 30 pages as opposed to the 3,000 pages of the Obama bill, so you can read it in a single sitting, envisions a transition over a 15-year period. I don't think it would take quite that long, because the savings that accrue and the benefits of covering 50 million more people, and by the way, eliminating Medicaid. You don't need Medicaid. Everybody has the same coverage here. So that program is gone. You hear the state. You might interview somebody sometime about the Medicaid program in New Hampshire. That program would be gone. And so as people saw the benefits of this, I think it would be like a avalanche or a tsunami. It would take on, it would come on board quite rapidly, perhaps within 3 to 5 years.
Has a single-payer system actually been implemented anywhere? And if so, how has it worked?
Well, of course, there's a number of different systems. I would encourage people to look at T.R. Reid's book called The Healing of America, where he describes systems in about 10 different countries. And he also has a program series on PBS, which was there before. But let's look at Taiwan, for example. In the early 90s, their healthcare system was in shambles. So they hired Professor Chow, an economics professor at Harvard, to design a program for them. And after looking at all of the programs available in the world, he came up with the Canadian-style program in Taiwan. That program is operating at about 6% GNP. we're spending 17% and rising rapidly in the United States, and their costs have been well controlled. And one of the ways they do it, we were talking before about quality and looking at people, outliers show up very quickly in that program. For example, I see approximately 25 to 30 patients a day. So if I suddenly started billing for 75 to 100 patients per day, the computer would flash in Taiwan very quickly, and somebody would be coming to visit that doctor. And if he didn't get his program back into a what would be expected, he would be eliminated from the program. They've done a very good job on cost cutting over there. Also, I think if you look at the other program in Germany, it's got a very good program. They do use insurance companies there. But as Reed said, there are really two components that must be fulfilled if you're going to have a system that covers. Everybody has to be included. Everybody in, nobody out. And you really have to have a not-for-profit insurance company system if you're going to have insurance companies at all.
In the end, do you believe we can continue with our present system, flawed though it may be, or is it only a matter of time until we must either accept some kind of reform or the system's going to crash and it's going to be forced upon us?
The system is going to crash. We're going to have single payer by 2020. The reason is, Charlie, is that premiums are rising, as we already discussed, 5 to 10 times the rate of inflation. Last year, I paid $20,000 for a family of four coverage for a $5,000 deductible policy. That was another 10% increase over the year before. Well, if you start to compound this out, you are going to have policies for a family of four of $35,000 or $40,000 or $50,000 by the end of this decade. Well, the median salary in the United States is only $50,000. So when those numbers cross, people are going to say, wait a minute, it's more for insurance than it is for your salary. This obviously can't stand.
At the outset, I began by saying the United States Supreme Court is soon going to be hearing oral arguments on the constitutionality of Obamacare. If you were given the opportunity to address the justices, what would you tell them?
Well, first of all, I think I would say that you do have to have a mandated system. Individual mandate is a system, or at least you have to pay into the system. Whether you want to participate, as we discussed before, is up to you, but most people would once they paid their money into it. I think that we do need to have a better program where people are included. So that would be a helpful way to do it. I think the Obama plan missed the boat here in a number of areas. First of all, they maintain the private health insurance system in the United States. So what they're mandating is that people buy into a private system. That's not right. So I wouldn't object if they threw it out and we started over. The problem is it's so polarized now in Washington. And you saw from Olympia Stowe's testimony in the paper the other day, probably in this environment and in this setting, impossible to get that done. Most of the guys are campaigning, the Republican side, saying, hey, let's get rid of Obamacare without even offering any option for you. It really, for the public, very concerning because you do have to have health insurance. You do have to have health care coverage. So my view for the Supreme Court would be that, yes, the mandate should be constitutional, but whether they keep it or not is something which is going to be highly up to debate.
Okay, Dr. Claremont, I want to thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to talk with me this morning about this very intriguing issue.
Charlie, thanks for having me, and look at our website if you want to get more information. It's Physicians for a National Health Program, PNHP.org. And there's if anybody interested in healthcare policy, you'll see a lot of good information there.
Thanks again, Dr. Claremont. This is Charlie Griffin reporting for WSCA on Radio Gazette.